So fix M and N and take the compact subset E in Rn. And suppose you're given a function phi, a real value function defined in E. Decide whether the function phi extends to a CM function f on all of Rn. That's Whitney's classic problem. If such an f exists, we want to know how small we can take its norm in CM. We'd like to know what we can say about its derivatives at a given point of E. And we would like to take the capital, we'd like to know whether we can take capital F to depend linearly on phi. This last is actually one of the hardest parts of the subject, and I'm only going to discuss it in these lectures by saying that the answer is yes. Okay. So with that, we don't worry about linear dependence. Okay, so before I state any theorems or even any definitions, I'd just like to make a few remarks on the effect of taking E infinite, whereas so far we've taken E finite. Okay. So first of all, suppose that we're given a function phi on a set E, and suppose that we know that F is a CM function on Rn, and its norm is of the order of magnitude capital M, and we know that capital F is equal to phi on E. Okay, so we have a CM function, we have a bound on its norm, and we know what it is on the set E. What can we say about the nth derivatives, the highest order derivatives of F at a given point of E? Now, the answer is, if E is finite, we can say nothing except for the obvious fact that the highest order derivatives are big O of M, because that's what we were told. We can say nothing. But if E is infinite, depending on the geometry of E, we may be able to say much more. And here are some simple examples to drive that out. Okay? So, here's a C2 function on the line. So the green curve is the graph of the C2 function. The set E is the large finite set of red dots. Okay. Now, it isn't marked on the slide, but imagine that the spacing between the red dots is, let's say, delta for some small number delta. And the vertical size of the two bumps is delta squared. If that's true, then we can take our function f to be zero at the red dots. We can take the C2 norm of f to be big O of 1. But even though f is zero at a whole lot of very closely spaced red dots, the second derivative of f at the single red dot x0 is of the order of magnitude 1. And so that's an indication that we are out of luck if we try to deduce information on the highest order derivatives. That's why, in the past, when we were looking at finite sets E, we only Taylor-expanded things to order M minus 1. On the other hand, let's look at an infinite set E. So now I'm looking at a C2 function on R1, and imagine that I tell you vanishes the red dots in this slide, where x0 is an accumulation point of the red dots. Well, if f is a C2 function, never mind its norm, if f is a C2 function and it's zero on all those red dots, then at the accumulation point x0, its second derivative is zero. We can tell exactly what the second derivative is. So that's a fundamental difference between finite E and infinite E. Okay. The second remark is that in order to solve Whitney's problem and decide whether a given phi extends, we're going to have to look at iterated limits, limits of limits, or maybe limits of limits of limits. So to see that, I'd like to show you an example, a very ingenious example that Glaser presented in 1958. So in Glaser's example, so I'm not going to tell you what the phi is, but I'm going to show you what the set E looks like. And it's an arc in the plane, a very strange-looking arc. And we're going to ask whether a given function on this strange-looking arc extends to a function in class C1 of the plane. So here's the strange-looking arc. It's the green curve. Notice that on the green curve, there are some red dots, C1, Z2, Z3, and so on. And they accumulate at the red dot Z infinity. Okay. Now, look at Z1. Z1 has two dotted straight lines leading to it. And and the green curve oscillates between those two dotted straight lines. Similarly, if you look at Z2, at the red dot Z2, it is the meeting point of two dotted straight lines, and the green curve oscillates between those two. And similarly for Z3, and similarly for Z4, and so on. Notice that the angles of at which pairs of dotted straight lines meet go rapidly to zero, so that as we approach Z infinity, not only is there a vertical tangent to the green curve at Z infinity, but in fact all the secant lines adjoining two points of the green curve close to Z infinity, all of those approach vertical. Okay, that's Glaser's example. The points in green are ordinary points. Z1, Z2, and so on are special points. Z infinity is the extra special point. Let's think about whether a given function on this funny green arc extends to a C1 function. Now, near an ordinary point, if we zoom into a small neighborhood, we've just got a harmless curve, and what we need about the function phi is simply that it should belong to C1. Okay. However, near a special point, some limits have to exist. In particular, at a special point ck, you can approach ck either by a limit, either as a limit of points v1, v2, v3, etc., lying on one dotted straight line, or as a limit of points w1, w2, w3, and so on, on the other straight line. The other dotted straight line. Okay? And so if you look at difference quotients involving v's, they have to tend to a limit, and they will tell you the directional derivative of your extension in the direction of the slanted dotted straight line. And on the other hand, if you look at difference quotients involving w's, they will tell you their limit will tell you the directional derivative of any extension in the vertical direction. And so from those two things, we recover the full gradient of f exactly at the point ck. So those limits have to exist. And once they exist, they tell you what the gradient of f is. OK, at the extra special point, an iterated limit has to exist, namely the limit of the gradients of f at the points ck. And so we recover the full gradient of z infinity as an iterated limit, but not as a single limit, because if you join any two points of the green curve and those two points lie near z infinity, the resulting line segment is approximately vertical. So in this case, you can compute things by iterated limits, but not by single limits. So that's Glaser's example. Okay, and so we will be seeing iterated limits. Okay, let's return to the general case. All right, now I'm now going to be reminding you of stuff from the first lecture, but with some more detail. So we're building on the early work of Glaser and on the work of Bierstone, Milman, and Halinsky, and we're going to solve Whitney's problem. And to do that, we're going to generalize it. So we fix the notation. We've got, let's see. We fix m and n greater than or equal to 1. We work in Cm of Rn. That's the space of all real value functions on Rn with continuous and bounded derivatives up to order m. There's my definition of the Cm, or of course there are lots of equivalent definitions that use that one. If f is in Cm and x is in Rn, jx of f denotes the nth degree Taylor polynomial of f, not the m minus first, the nth, because as we just saw, when p is infinite, we need to pay attention to the highest order derivatives as well. Okay, so in this hour, unlike the last hour, when we write script p, it means the vector space of all nth degree polynomials, and so jx of f belongs to that script. All right. Now, given a point x, remember there's a natural multiplication on script p, jet multiplication, denoted as on the slide, and simply given two polynomials to find their product as jets, you take their product as polynomials and then Taylor expand about x to order m. So the point of that is that the jet of the product of two smooth functions is the jet product of their jets for fg and cm. And so the ring of jets at x, which is denoted by r sub x, is the vector space script p equipped with the multiplication of jets at x. Okay, am I right? So that's elementary, easily understood, and for that matter, we're reviewing. Okay. All right. So now remember, to generalize Whitney's problem, we introduce the notion of a bundle. So here's a bundle. A bundle is a collection, as on the slide, a collection of affine subspaces of script p indexed by the points x of a compact subset e in Rn. So compactness of the base e is part of the definition of bundle. If e is not compact, h is not a bundle. And the h's are of a special form. For each particular point x and e, either h of x is the empty set, which by convention we declare is an acceptable affine space. Okay. Either h is the empty set, or it is a translative an ideal or a coset of an ideal. So h of x might have the form f of x plus I of x, where f of x belongs to r of x, that is, it's an infinite degree polynomial, and I of x, sitting inside r of x, is an ideal with respect to general multiplication. Okay, that's what a bundle is. And again, that's a review from the first lecture. We call E the base, we call h of x the fiber, and we make no assumption on how h of x depends on x. Okay, of course, for the bundles in geometry are supposed to look locally like products or something. But here we make absolutely no assumptions. So for example, h of x is an affine subspace of script p. The dimension of that affine subspace needn't be a measurable function of the point. This is just completely arbitrary. Okay? If h and h prime are two bundles over the same base, h prime is a subbundle written as if it were set inclusion, provided that the fiber of the bigger guy contains the fiber of the smaller one for each point of the base. So that's what a subbundle is. Okay, allowing the empty set as a fiber seems strange, but we will soon see why it's a good idea. In fact, maybe I don't remember, maybe you all also don't remember, whether in the first lecture I explained why it was a good idea. Okay, so let script H be a bundle. A section of the bundle is a function in CM whose jet at each point of E belongs to the fiber H of X. Okay. That's the definition of a section of a bundle. And obviously that can't happen if H has any empty fibers. Okay. So now, with all that jargon, one can now state the generalized Whitney problems. Here they are. Given a bundle, decide whether it has a section. If it has a section, how small can we take the CM norm of a section? Let's take a bundle, and let's fix a particular point of the base, and let's fix a particular polynomial lying in the fiber. Please decide whether H has a section such that the jet at that point is that polynomial. That's a refined version of the first question. Are there any sections? Now, if there are sections, what can we say about the jet of the section at a particular point? Okay. Okay. Now, the classical Whitney problems from the beginning of the lecture are special cases of these generalized Whitney problems. Let's check that. So, suppose that E is a compact set, and phi is a real valued function on E. We want to know whether there's a CM function that agrees with phi on E. Well, let's define a bundle. In order to define it, for each x and e, let's take f of x equal to the constant polynomial whose value everywhere is phi of x. And let's take I of x to be the set of all polynomials in script p that vanish at the point x. And that's an ideal in script x. I'm sorry, in script r sub x. And so we take H to be the sum of those, so the H is a translative and ideal, and the collection of all of those is therefore a bundle. And if you think for just a second, out the time pressure of following these slides, you see h of x is simply the set of all polynomials p that agree with phi at the single point x. So h is a bundle, and the section of that bundle is precisely a CM function that agrees with phi on the setting. And therefore, for that particular bundle, the question, does h have a section, means, is there a CM function that agrees with phi on E? And for that particular bundle, the question, how small can we take the norm of a section of H, means, how small can we take the CM norm of a function that agrees with phi on E? And for this bundle, the question, does H have a section that takes, at a given jet, at a given point, means, is there a CM function that agrees with phi on E and has a given jet at a given point? So those are all of the classical Whitney questions except for linearity. And there is a version of, there's a bundle version of the classical question, can we take F to depend linearly on phi? But again, that's actually the hardest part of the story, and so I'm not going to talk about it except to say that the answer is yes. Okay, so we have generalized Whitney's classical question to the setting of bundles. And now we're going to solve it by introducing the idea of Glaeser refinements. Okay. So given a bundle, H, we're going to define another bundle, H tilde, which is called the Glaeser refinement of H, in such a way that three key properties hold. Here are the three key properties. So let H tilde be the Glaeser refinement of H. Then H tilde is a subbundle of H. But nevertheless, every section of H is already a section of H tilde. Even though H tilde has gotten smaller, the stuff we've discarded from H to produce H tilde is irrelevant junk. Okay. Moreover, H tilde can be computed from H by doing linear algebra in fixed dimension and taking a limit. Okay. Now, in the first lecture, I mentioned these properties, but I didn't define the Glaeser refinement. Let me now motivate the definition and then give the definition. So to motivate the definition, I want to just recall a simple corollary of Taylor's theorem. So here's the corollary. We have a CM function capital F at a point x0. Okay. Given epsilon, there exists a delta such that if you take any two points, x prime and x double prime, in the ball of radius delta about x0, then the jets at x prime and x double prime, which we denote by p prime and p double prime, satisfy the inequality in the slot. So if there were not an epsilon there, if there were just a constant, that would say that the nth derivatives are bounded. But we can put an epsilon there because we're Taylor expanding to nth order and the nth derivatives are continuous. Okay? So that obvious corollary of Taylor's theorem motivates the definition of Glaeser refinement, and now let's give it. So I want to define the Glaeser refinement H tilde of the bundle H. To do that, we fix a large enough integer constant K depending only on little m and little l. For each point x0 in E, I have to tell you what H tilde of x0 is. It is defined to consist of all the p0 in h of x0 for which something happens. Namely, what? Well, here's what has to happen for that p0. Given epsilon, there exists delta, such that if you pick any k points, x1 through xk of E, that lie within the ball b of x0 delta, then we can find polynomials p1 in h of x1 through pk in h of xk, such that the inequality at the bottom there holds for all alpha up to order m, less than or equal to m, and for all ij running from 0 through k. Okay. Now, let me remark a couple of things. This k is not arbitrarily large. Remember, we picked an integer constant k depending on only on m and n, and we fixed it once and for all. So we are not looking at arbitrarily large collections of points. We're looking at k tuples of points for a fixed k. Notice also that the inequalities here involve p0 through pk, but p0 plays a different role from P1 through PK. P0 and X0 is a given point, and P0 is a polynomial which we are testing to see whether it belongs to the Lorenzo refinement. They are fixed. On the other hand, for all X1 through XK in E intersect this ball, there exist P1 through PK which depend on X1 through XK while P0 is staying fixed. Okay. So P0 is different from P1 through PK. It's a different kind of animal. But nevertheless, these estimates are supposed to hold for P0 through PK. Okay. That's the definition of the laser refinement. Okay. So in a moment, we'll check that the laser refinement has the three key properties just asserted, but first a few remarks. Alright, the first remark is what I've just been saying. Okay. Second remark is a little embarrassing feature of the notation. In a degenerate case in which xi is equal to xj, and we differentiate to order precisely m, then the right hand side of the inequality, look at the inequality. It involves the quantity xi minus xj to the power n minus alpha. That becomes 0 to the 0. And so by convention, we declare that 0 to the 0 is equal to 0. That removes trivial degenerate cases. Okay, and the third remark is that the Glaser refinement might have some empty fibers, even if H has none. And so the reason for allowing empty fibers is to guarantee that the Glaser refinement of a bundle is a bundle. So one still has to check that the Glaser refinement is a bundle, even with this modified definition allowing empty fibers, but it is. Okay. And finally, the solution to the generalized Whitney problem will involve Glaser refinements. And if you start with the example of a bundle that came directly from Whitney's problem, and if you Glaser refine that bundle, it no longer obviously has anything to do with Whitney's problem, which is why we had to generalize the problem to bundles. All right, so now let's check if Glaser refinements have the promised three basic properties. Okay, well, first of all, H tilde is a subbundle of H, and the problem is that's obvious, because the fiber H tilde of the Glaser refinement is defined to consist of all polynomials in the fiber of the original bundle that do something or other. So of course, the fiber of the Glaser refinement is contained in the fiber of the original bundle. So it's a subbundle. Simple as that. Okay? So it's a matter of remembering the definitions. Also, every section... there's a misprint. Every section of H is also a section of H tilde. Every section of H tilde is also a section of H because H tilde is a subbundle. Thank you. Every section of H is a subbundle of H tilde. Why? Take any section of H, or take any point, x0 and e. I have to show you that p0, which is the jet at x0 of f, belongs to the fiber of, not merely to the fiber of H, as assumed, but even to the fiber of the Glaser refinement. Well, what does that mean? That means that p0 belongs to H, that's the condition in the first red box, and that given epsilon, there exists delta such that one will belong to the second red box. Now let's look into red boxes. P0 would be using H of x0, is that true? Yes, we're given that f is a section of H, and so that's true. How about the second red box? Let's actually give you what's in it. Given epsilon, there exists delta such that for any points x1 through xk of E that lie in E of x0 delta, there exist p1 and h of x1 through pk of h of xk that satisfy this estimate for I and j running from 0 through k. Is that true? Yes, it's immediate from the corollary of Taylor's theorem that I just mentioned a moment ago, because I can just take p1 to be the jet of f at x1, and similarly for all of the others, p sub k is the jet of f at xk. Notice that p1 belongs to h of x1, etc. pk belongs to h of xk, because f is assumed to be a section of h. And the estimate of those p's is precisely the little corollary of Taylor's theorem. So therefore, every section of h is also a section of h2. Okay? And finally, h tilde can be computed from h by doing linear algebra in fixed dimension and taking the limit. So we, let's fix a point x0 in a polynomial p0 in h of x0, and let's decide whether p0 belongs to the fiber, the Glaser fiber. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay. All right, so I'm going to define a function. So this is, all right, so for any x1 through xk in E, and any p1 through pk in the Cartesian product of the fibers h of x1 through h of xk, I'm going to set q of p1 through pk with respect to x1 through xk to be the sum of squares that you see in the slide. Okay. Now, for fixed x1 through xk, this function is a quadratic function on an affine space. Okay. So I can minimize it by doing linear algebra in fixed dimension because the number of points k is fixed. And so by doing linear algebra in fixed dimension, I can compute what I call q min of x1 through xk, which is the minimum of the thing in the red box over all possible p's that are constrained, each p to lie in the corresponding fiber, h. Okay, clear?
Charlie, it depends on p0 also?
And it certainly depends on p0, but I'm imagining that p0 is fixed. So it depends on p0, it depends on x0, but they are fixed. So yes, certainly. So, all right, we can criticize my notation. All right, if that's the worst thing one can criticize, I'm okay. All right, so we have this qmin. Which yes, depends on x0. So, all right, so we have computed it, and if you compare the definitions of q and q min with the definition of h tilde of x0, you can see that p0 belongs to the fiber of the Glaser refinement if and only if q min tends to 0 as the tuple x1 through xk in the repeated Cartesian product of E with itself tends to the point x0, x0, x0. So that's a question going through and checking the definitions. All right, and so as promised, we can decide whether P0 is in the fiber of the Glaser refinement by doing linear algebra in fixed dimension to compute Q min and then taking the limit of Q min. Okay, and so the three basic properties alleged in the Glaser refinement are actually true. All right, well, now that we have the Glaser refinement and now that the Glaser refinement has the properties we promised, let's use it. So we want to know whether a given bundle H0 has a section. So let's say H1 has the Glaser refinement of H0. Well, remember the three basic properties of the Glaser refinement. We can compute H1 from H0. H1 and H0 have the same sections, but H1 is a subbundle of H0. So we passed from H0 to H1 by removing some junk. Namely, by removing from the fibers of H0 certain polynomials that can never arise as the jetting of a section. So we made progress. Well, let's make more progress so we can keep going. And so we let H2 be the Glaser refinement of H1. We let H3 be the Glaser refinement of H2, and so on. And so we obtain successively bundles H0, H1, H2, etc., so that each one is a subbundle of the preceding one, and yet they all have the same sections, and we can compute any particular one starting from H0. So we make more and more progress. Of course, we don't want to do this forever, otherwise we will never stop and never answer the question. We just feel better and better about making more and more progress. However, all right, and so these are called the iterated Glaser refinements of the thing we started with. However, the process is stabilized. So by adapting a single ingenious lemma of Bierstein-Milner-Bohutsky, which in turn was adapted from a single ingenious lemma of Glaser, we obtain the following result. Let L star be twice the dimension of script p plus 1. Then the iterated Glaser refinements from L star on are all the same. So there is no point in iterating more than L star times. This L star is is, of course, determined by little m, and we can use it, but it may not be optimal. There's an old paper of O.S. Partog and Martin Zobel identifying the optimal delta star, maybe up to a negative plus or minus 1 for the case of C1. But anyway, let's use this L star. And so there's no point in iterating more times than that. The proof of the Glaser stabilization lemma is remarkably simple and completely elementary. It says here we'll give it at the end of this talk if there's enough time, but I think I've decided that you've suffered enough, and I can just characterize it a little and not actually give it, even though it's very simple. Okay. All right, so here's where we stand. We're given a bundle. We compute its ELF iterative Glaser refinement, HL, for L equals 1, 2, through L star. And so at L star we stop because there's no point in going further. And so H L star may be computed from H. H L star and H have the same sections. And so all of our questions about H are equivalent to the corresponding questions for H L star. But H L star has one other very important property that H didn't have, namely H L star is its own Glaser. So let's call HL star the stable Glaser refinement of H, and we will say that it is Glaser stable. Okay, so well, remember the generalized Whitney problems. Here they are. Given a bundle, does it have a section? If it has a section, how small can we take the norm? What can we say about the jet of a section at a given point? And without loss of generality, we may replace H by its stable Glaser refinement. So we'll ask all of those questions for Glaser stable bundles, and if we can do that, we have answered the generalized Whitney problems. And so here's the main theorem. Let H be a Glaser stable bundle, then H has a section if and only if all its fibers are not empty. Of course, if any fibers are empty, it has no sections. That's completely obvious. But that's the only obstruction. If H is Glaser stable and all its fibers are not empty, then it has a section. End of story. Well, not quite end of story. There's a corollary. Suppose we have a Glaser stable bundle with non-empty fibers. Suppose I give you any point x0 in the base, and I give you any polynomial p0 in the fiber. Then not only does there exist a section, there actually exists a section for which the jet at the given point is the given polynomial. So, in passing from a bundle to its stable Glaser refinement, we've removed junk by taking iterated limits and such. And after we've removed the junk, we are left precisely with the jets that can arise as sections. Now, the theorem itself is hard to prove, and we will suffer through it tomorrow. But the corollary follows very, very easily from the theorem, so I'd like to explain that. Okay. So let H be a Glaser stable bundle with non-empty fibers. Let X0 be a point in E, and let P0 be a point in be a polynomial in the fiber. I'm going to define a new bundle, H hat. And H hat is going to have fibers that I call Roman H hat. H hat of x is exactly the same as h of x for all the points of E except for the single point x0. At x0, h hat of x0 is going to consist of a single polynomial p0. If you look at the definition of a Glaser stable bundle, you'll find that if h was a Glaser stable bundle, so is h hat. And of course, if all the fibers of h are not empty, then also all of the fibers of h hat are not empty. So we're going to apply the main theorem to H hat. So H hat has a section. Okay. A section means that the jet belongs to the fiber Roman H hat at every particular point. But in particular, at the point x0, there is only one point in the fiber, it's h0. And so script H hat has a section, and a section of script H hat is precisely a function in CN, for which the jet belongs to the H of X for all X, but in particular, the jet at X0 is P0, and so that proves the corollary. So the corollary is utterly trivial from the theorem, which is considerably less true. Okay, now we'd also like to know, we'd also like to know how small we can take the CM norm of a section of a given bundle. And that information is supplied by a finiteness theorem for quasi-stable bundles, and I'd like to explain that. So recall that we've fixed a large enough integer constant k depending only on m and n. Let script h be a bundle with non-empty fibers. I'm going to define its norm, written as on the slide as if it were a function vector. The norm is the least non-negative number capital M for which the following holds. Given any k points of E, remember k is this large integer constant, given any k points of E, there exist polynomials P1 through PK lying in the fibers corresponding to X1 through Xk that satisfy the conditions of the red box. And those are the obvious conditions that they would have to satisfy if these P's were the jets at the points x1 through xk of the function with cm norm equals capital M. Okay. So that's the least m for which such a thing happens is called the norm. Now, of course, there may not be any such m, in which case we define the norm to be infinite. So now I have a definition of norm. Okay, if script H is a Glaser-stable bundle whose fibers are all non-empty, its norm is finite. I am very rapidly. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I'm going to say I'm very rapidly running out of time. I have lots of time.
20 minutes.
So the norm is finite. I will tell you something about the proof of this somewhere between omitting it entirely. This is very roughly analogous to the fact that continuous function on a compact set is bounded. The proof is similar to that, as we'll see. So the lemma tells us absolutely nothing about how big the norm might be when it is finite, just as the soup of a continuous function on a compact set is finite, but we know that we have no idea how big it is. Okay. So a little later it says we'll sketch the proof of the. First, we'll answer the question, how small can we take the CM norm of a section of H? That was one of our basic questions, our generalized unit questions. And there is then a